We're holding on page Lamed Tes in Bava Metzia, the top of the page, middle of Os, nun, middle of Os Mem Tes. Ashoyel Perek Shmini, so the subject of the Perek, most of the Perek is the dinim of Ashoyel. In general, we know Ashoyel is responsible for anything that happens to the thing, even Onus. The only exception is Mesa Machmas Malacha, if the thing died or otherwise was destroyed in the normal course of using it. So, you borrow somebody's bucket, the Gemara gives an example, and you use it to draw water, and it breaks or rips. To put a more modern example of it, you borrow somebody's car, let's say, and you're driving it perfectly normally, and the engine dies. Those kinds of things are called Mesa Machmas Malacha. So the Gemara goes into various ins and outs of what's considered that, and the Gemara gives the following example. Ahu Gavra, there was a person, Deshol Shunra Mechabre. He borrowed a cat from somebody else. He had mice in his house. He wanted to borrow a cat to get rid of the mice. Chovra Le Achbre, the mice ganged up against the cat, the Katlua, and they killed it. Yosef Rav Ashi become a boy. So Rav Ashi was sitting and wondering, what would be the case? What would be the din in this kind of situation? He may say machmas malacha domi or loy. Do we consider it may say machmas malacha or not? Tosfos points out, in other words, the question is, you know, on the face of it, you'd say, well, it's classic may say machmas malacha. It was supposed to catch mice. It failed to catch the mice, and instead it died in the attempt. But Tosfos points out, the question is really, the place was obviously so infested with mice that there were enough of them to be able to gang up against the cat. Maybe that's not may say machmas malacha. Maybe that's the equivalent of using the thing that you borrowed in a place or in a way that you're not supposed to. Or not. Omer le Rav Mordechai le Rav Ashi, so Rav Mordechai tells him, Hochi Omer, Avimi Mehagrunya Meshmei de Rava, this is what Avimi Mehagrunya said in the name of Rava in a similar kind of case, Gavri Denoshi Katlua, a man who was killed by women, where in other words they were able to gang up on him and attack him, Loi Dina Veloi Dayana, there's no Din and there's no Dayan, meaning in other words kind of it's his own fault. He's supposed to be stronger, right? Talking that he allowed himself to be overpowered by weaker people. Rashi doesn't say it. Rashi just said, Loi Hoyo Lipo Biyodan, he shouldn't have fallen into their hands. Yeah, Rashi doesn't explain. No, that's the second one. Hold on. That's the second one. So we're talking about in the first case, Pashat, that they ganged up against him and attacked him and killed him, and Loidina Veloidayana, what is he doing then, being so weak that he managed to fall into their hands? Ikadamri, another version of what happened was, not that the mice ganged up on the cat, Ochel Achri Tuva, in the second version, the cat ate too many of the mice, the Chovel Amis, and so it got overheated and died. Or Shitamukubetsis brings a girsa of a chonich or something like that, which means like it got bloated and it died, whatever, same difference. And again, in the second version also, Yosef Rav Ashi, Vekoma Ayin Bar, Rav Ashi was sitting and looking at it, Kahai Gavna Mai, what would be the din in this case? Is this considered Mesa Machmas Malacha? And in the second version too, Omele Rav Mordechai Rav Ashi. So Rav Mordechai says to Rav Ashi, a similar kind of thing, Hochi Oma Avimi Magrunya, Gavra Denoshi Katlua, a man who was killed by women, in this case, meaning not that they fought him and they won, but in this case, that he had relations with too many women, and died, Loi Din of Loi Dayana, then there's no Din and no Dayan, because he shouldn't have overindulged himself like that. Nice. So in the first version, the mice ganged up on the cat and killed it, which is the equivalent of the person being overpowered by women. In the second version, the cat allowed itself to go too far with its tivus of eating the mice, and the equivalent is a man doing the same thing with the women. Shittu B'chubetzis brings from Rabbeinu Hananel, and Ben Yehoyada says the same thing independently, that what we can be talking about, why would we even think Loi Din of Loi Dayana, what kind of a din would there be in the first case, in the first place? So they talk about, let's say, for example, a man has a bunch of shvachis, he has a bunch of maidservants, he wants to have children, he wants that there should be children of theirs who will be the next generation of Avadim. So he hires somebody's Eved to have relations with them in order to father children, and the Eved ends up overindulging and overexerting himself and dies, so Loi Din of Loi Dayana, the owner of the Eved, won't have a valid claim against the other guy, because you know it's his fault. Who told him to do ad kedekach? Opponent points out, you know, there's something we can learn from this, that a person needs to factor, we're not just talking about cats and mice and men and women, we're talking about b'chlal, you know, a person is on a higher level, how can he allow himself to be overpowered and defeated by people who are lower or weaker than him, the gashmias or beruchnias? Or in the second version, well, what's a person doing, letting his yetzahara run away with him like that, to the extent that this cat did, or to the extent that the man in the mushal did? A person needs to control his own yetzahara and not allow it to get the better of him and harm him, the gashmias or beruchnias.
Were the kings able to control themselves? Did they show that they controlled themselves even though they had so many wives?
So were the kings able to control themselves? I don't know. I mean, the Torah does limit them to 18 wives, you know. Didn't die, it's true, right? Even Shlomo HaMelech had 1,000 wives, he didn't die from it, it's true. Yeah, I guess, yeah. I was mentioning the other day in this shiur a point that the Das Sofrin makes, that we find a pasuk in Kehelas where Shlomo refers to having 100 children as like an unattainable ideal. In Yerlid Ishmeya, he says, and he had 700 regular wives and 300 concubines, 300 pelagim, most of them evidently didn't have children. So you see, evidently, even though he had all those wives and all those pelagim, he knew how to moderate himself and not be like the guy in this mushal over here. Yeah.
I'm sorry to say this, but what about the Oinah? How does he think?
How he dealt with Oinah, I don't know. I mean, the halacha is that the Oinah gets divided by the number of women. The halacha is, for example, you have, let's say, a man whose Oinah is once a week. If he has 4 wives and his Oinah with each of them is once a month, then I'm right. Based on that, there's a Gemara in Ksubas, I think, that recommends that a man shouldn't have more than 4 wives, because that way at least they should get an Oinah once a week. With Shlomo and his 1,000 wives, I don't know how it worked. I mean,
those women could forgive it if they want.
I guess, yeah, they can forgive it if they want you. I mean, you have to realize when a king marries a lot of wives, you know, it's not like when a man marries a wife, there's a lot of different factors, there's a lot of different reasons for it, that why a man gets married. With a king, you don't necessarily have those reasons. It's not like, for example, he needs somebody to help keep house for him, you know, he's got plenty of servants and maidservants for that. Part of his politics, indeed, to make alliances. In Shlomo's case, he wanted to be able to have a connection with the Umas HaOlam and be able to inspire them with Shev Mitzvot Ninayach and all that. There's also within the Jewish people themselves, a king wants to marry women from the kingdom itself in order to strengthen alliances with various powerful noblemen or various parts of the kingdom that may be opposed to him or whatever. And then this way also, another point of it is also this way he has more children that then he can trust them and appoint them to positions of power to lead the administration in the next generation. So yeah. Fine. I'm a Kabbal Perchi. So the main focus of a large part of this perek is when a person is a tenant farmer by somebody else. Now you have an arrangement called an oris, which is mentioned throughout Shas, where the deal is, it's my field, you're working it for me, you're going to get a percentage of the crops. So the bigger the crop, the more your haul is going to be. Then you have a different kind, that kind of thing is called, that can be called makabel generically, in the narrower sense it's called an oris. Then you have another kind of makabel is called a choicher, which is where the deal is that the rent is going to be X amount of produce per year. So it's a wheat field, for example. The deal is you're going to pay me 10 kor of wheat per year. Doesn't matter whether the yield of the field was exactly 10, and then you're going to have to give me all of it. If it was less than that, sometimes you might even have to buy wheat on the open market and give it to me. And then on the other hand, if it produces 1,000 kor, then you're making out, because then you're making out with a bandit, because you only have to give me 10, and you're getting to keep 990 for yourself. So most of the perek, and much of the perek, deals with the ins and outs of those dinim, when different dinim that apply to one or the other or both of those. So one of the mishnayos in the perek deals with a case where a person is choicher a field and it doesn't produce enough to be worthwhile. So then, under what circumstances do you have to keep on trying to plant and keep on trying to work, even though he's not really going to get much out of it, versus not? So the Mishnah deals with those dinim. And so now, the Gemara brings the following piece regarding peiros, regarding produce that don't produce very much compared to what they should be expected to. Tznan Hossam, we learn in a Mishnah in Masechta Taras, I think, Poritze Zeisim Va'anovim. Poritze, which the Gemara is going to explain, there's a word for reshoyim of olives and grapes. So these are ones that are never going to fully ripen. Beshamai matamin. Beshamai says there's still makabel chuma. Ubisilamatarin, the Sillel says they're not makabel truma because they're not makabel truma of Tumas Eichlin because they're not edible. So Rashi explains basically they always remain unripe. So they're inedible. My Poritze Zesim, why are we calling them Poritze Zesim? I'm going to put a Rishe Zesim. The word Poritze means kind of the wicked olives or grapes. Where do we see that the word Poritze means wicked, Rishoyim? Amr of Yosef Maikra, where is a pasuk that expresses that point, that Poritze means Rishoyim? You have a pasuk in Daniel talking about during the period when during a certain period of Jewish history, during the time when the Greeks or the Romans were ruling over Eretz Yisrael, the pasuk says, Uvnei Poritze Amcha, the children of the Rishoyim of your people, Yinasu, will lift themselves up, Lahamid Chazen, to establish the vision, to claim that they're Mashiach and that they're bringing the Gulam to Sasha. And they'll stumble and fall. The Rambam says specifically it refers to Oser Ish. In general, during that period of the late second Beis Mikdash, there were quite a lot of people who were running around claiming that they're Mashiach and different things on there, that they're going to redeem the Jewish people from the Greeks or from the Romans. So all of them are included on this Bnei Paritze Amcha. So we see that the word Paritze means lawless and Rishoyim. So in the same way, these things are called Rishoyim. These grapes or olives are called Rishoyim. In the sense that they never reach their potential. Habona points out, we can learn from this also. A person's potential, a person is put into this world in order to accomplish in Avoda. So now if he fails to do that, or Rosha doesn't accomplish what he's put in this world for, so he can be compared to unripe grapes or olives. A person tries to eat them and they set his teeth on edge. Makas shinam, they blunts his teeth trying to eat them, and therefore the Gemara hints to that by calling them poritze. I mean, you could say, what's it, the fault of the grapes or the olives? But the point is they're meant as a mushel for people who don't live up to the potential that the Eibush to put them in the world for. Ben Yehoyada points out another point as well. We've talked about before the idea that sometimes a person goes through Gilgulim, a person Neshamas goes through Gilgulim sometimes, and sometimes, as we talked about before, it's Nisgalgal into a lower life form. We talked about a couple of weeks ago a story from Shevet Musar about a person who was Nisgalgal in a bull that was supposed to be used for a bullfight, and the guy comes to his son in a dream and tells him, you've got to be Poydami. And there's other examples like that where we find Chassidish and Maisalach and things like that where a person is Nisgalgal in some kind of plant or whatever. So here you have, in other words, you can have a person's Neshama was Nisgalgal in these grapes or olives. Well, if they're edible and they get turned into wine or oil, then they can be used. They can be eaten or drunk by somebody who says a bracha on them and uses the energy for Avodas Hashem. Whereas if they're Poritze Zeisim Anum, if they're inedible, then he's not gonna have that opportunity and therefore his Neshama is not gonna have its tikkun. That's another reason to call them Poritze. Rav Nachman Yitzchok Amar Mehacha. Rav Nachman Yitzchok says you have a different pasuk where we see that the word Poritze means Rishoyim. Yechezkel describes a scenario. He describes you have a person who is a tzaddik, and then Vahulad Ben Poritz Shreifach Dom, and he fathers a son who is a Poritz, a Rasha, who spills blood and commits other crimes. So we see there also that the word Poritz means a Rasha. The point Yechezkel is making over there that the schusim of the father don't protect the son. And then conversely, if the son himself ends up having this Rosha, the son ends up having a child as a tzaddik, then the tzaddik, the grandson, is not going to suffer for the averus of his father. This is the whole perek of Yechezkel explaining how the Eibishter works with these things. Mistama also, when we have in all the stories of the Poritzim in Poland and Russia, Mistama, the word Poritz for them probably came from this as well. They in general, they were not such nice people, to put it mildly. Ben Yehoyada points out, why does Rav Nachman Yitzchok need a different pasuk? Because not Ben Yehoyada, actually, Rav Yaakov Emden, Agos Yavetz, points out that in the first pasuk, if you didn't know, you might think maybe Poritze over there was actually meant as a compliment. These people, after all, are trying to bring Mashiach. So therefore, we need the second pasuk to clarify that no, Poritze does in fact mean Rishoyim, and no, the pasuk in Daniel means that these are Rishoyim who are pretending to be Mashiach and turn out to be nothing of the sort. Okay. Further on, the Gemara is dealing with certain dinim about the size of the amount of the crop that the field might produce, and then dealing with certain dinim about the size of the trees and things like that, the size of branches so that are relevant as far as certain halachas, and eventually the Gemara digresses from one topic to another and gets to the following din. Tanya. If a person is carrying a burden on his head, or tefillin b'roshay, and he also is wearing tefillin on his head, because we know in those times people would often wear tefillin all day long. So im hayu tefillin roitzot, if the tefillin are being crushed by the burden, also, then it's also to carry something else on his head while he's wearing the tefillin. V'im lav mutter, and if not, then it's mutter. The Eze Masi Omru, what kind of burden are we talking about? How big does it have to be a problem? The Masi Shalabas Kavin is where the burden is 4 kavim or more. Kav is, strictly speaking, a measure of volume, but in terms of volume, it would be, if the volume of about three pounds of water, so you're talking about it would be the volume of 12 pounds. So when it's that size, then we consider it's going to be crushing the tefillin or at least moving them out of place, and then, so that would be also. That's what we're saying. If we're talking about, so the next thing we're going to talk about is where the burden itself is something that doesn't belong near tefillin. We're going to talk about a person who's carrying manure. Here we're talking about a person who's carrying stam, something else. So there's no specific bezoyin to the tefillin in and of itself, but according to this opinion, we're going to see in a second a different opinion, which is halacha, but wait. But here we're talking about, according to this braisa, as long as in and of itself the thing is not something mevuza, then you're allowed to carry it on your head the same time you're wearing tefillin, just as long as it's not 4 kavim or more. Toni Rav Chiya teaches in a braisa. On the other hand, hamotzi zevel al roshay. On the other hand, if a person is carrying out a container of manure on his head, or tefillin b'roshay, and he has tefillin on his head, hadeiz a lo yisalkem now. And now that's a different matter, because there you're talking about the burden, the contents of the burden itself, the contents of the package themselves are something that's disrespectful to have anywhere near the tefillin. Hadeiz a lo yisalkem l'tzadim, so he shouldn't move his tefillin shal roshay to the side. V'lo yikrim b'masna, he shouldn't tie it around his waist. Because that would be a bezoyin of treating the tefillin that way. However, what he can do is he can tie them on his left arm in the place where his tefillin shoyad would go. So the Gemara often mentions in a number of places that in each place where the shoyad and the shorosh go, there's strictly speaking room for 2 pair of tefillin. Not maybe nowadays with our enormous Lubavitcher Dalit al Dalit tefillin, but the smaller kind that they wear in the velt. And sometimes you go sometime into a writer, the surfer. He has God Sabag's store. He has a pair of tefillin over there, like 1 centimeter in size that somebody made and wore during the Holocaust. So those kind of, but even fine, we're not talking that small maybe, but talking about, you know, the kind that the velt wears that are much smaller, you can fit 2 of them in the place of tefillin. Sometimes you see people who wear Rashi and a bit of Tams together. So therefore, so the same idea, in other words, he can take the tefillin shorosh and tie it onto his arm next to or in place of his tefillin shoyat. A point that the poskim make is zapka on his left arm, because his right arm is going to be used for doing work, and it's less respectful for him to wear tefillin on that the tefillin shorosh even temporarily on that arm. But the left hand he's using less for work, so therefore it's fine. On the other hand, the Gemara continues, Mishum Dvei Reb Shila Omru, Afilu Mit Pachas Shalahen Oso Laniach Al Rosh Shiyesh Beit Filin. No, not like we were saying that as long as it's less than 4 kavim, then you're allowed to wear it. No, even the handkerchief that you use, the bag that you use to wrap up tefillin, also it's also to put it on the head when your tefillin are on your head. So never mind 4 kavim, and you're not allowed to put anything on your head when you're wearing tefillin. Tosfos has a different gusa from Rabbeinu Chananel, not mitachas shalahen, their mitachas, but rather mitachas shalechem, a cloth like a dekel that you would use for bread. Tosfos points out, because yeah, we find in different places the Gemara uses different other expressions for the kind of container that you put tefillin in, and the Gemara never seems to use the word mitachas for such a thing. So therefore, so what do you mean mitachas shalahen? There's no mitachas shalahen because they're not usually placed in a mitachas. So rather it would mean something else. It would mean like Tosfos says mitachas shalechem, even a cloth that you use to cover bread, for example. So the point is, in other words, the gnai, that something which is not a beged should be on your head, which is when it's not normally on your head. The kama, and how much is a problem? Amar Abaya, after the riba, the pumbedisa, even if it's a quarter of a liter, A liter is a measure of approximately a pound. A quarter of that then would be around 3 ounces, give or take, that they use in Pumpa Dissa. That was the smallest weight that they used in common use. Nevertheless, you're still not allowed to have it on your head together with the tefillin. So, and that's the halacha. You are allowed to wear your hat while you're wearing your tefillin, because that's a malbush, that's a regular piece of clothing, and therefore you're allowed to. However, the Alter Rebbe does add that if the thing that we said about four kavim does still apply, namely if the hat is heavier than four kavim and it's pushing the tefillin out of place, then you're not allowed to. Given that four kavim is something in the area of 10 to 12 pounds, I don't know how many people would wear such a hat anyway, but hypothetically, if they were, then you're... What? Strangles that heavy? I don't know. Could be. Never weighed one. I don't know. Could be. I guess people in practice don't wear their strangle when they're wearing their tefillin. I don't know. In any case, for that kind of thing, then not. So really, both dinim that we're saying over here are true. Basically, you're not allowed to do anything if it doesn't usually go on your head, not even if it's lightweight. But if it's something that belongs on your head, a yarmulke, a hat, then you're allowed to, provided that it's not four cabin. The Mishnah goes on, and Hamakabel Sodim Chaveri, a person is Makabel a field from somebody else. Again, we're talking about this case of Choycher, where he's paying a fixed rent per year, X number of kurim or X number of bushels or whatever of produce. The Ochla Chogav, and the field where the crop in the field was consumed by locusts, or Nishtefa, or was blasted by an east wind. If it's something that affected the whole area, then he's entitled to deduct from his rent for it. So in other words, this field would have normally been expected to produce X amount, and he would have given his rent to the owner of the field. Now that there was a Makas Medina, he's entitled to say, I'm entitled to a reduction in rent for this year because the field didn't, because there's not enough of a crop because of the locusts or the whatever. As opposed to, if it affected only that field, then no, he doesn't have that, then he doesn't have that. So, the Gemara points out, Amar Shmuel, lo yishonu elisha zorav et samcha v'ochla chogav. When would that apply if he did plant it, and it started growing, and then locusts came and ate it? Ava lo yizorav klal, but if he didn't even plant it in the first place, loy, then he doesn't have a right to demand a reduction in the rent. Because the owner of the field can tell him, now on the face of it, why? The choicher should be able to argue, look, either way, the crop was destroyed. So what do you want from me? One way or the other, you wouldn't have had a crop. What's the difference? Whether I actually planted or not? The reason is because the owner can tell him, if you had planted it, have a makayim bi, then there could have been fulfilled in me the bracha that says in the pasuk, lo ye voshu be'esra, that they won't be embarrassed in a time of evil, or we made oven yisbo, in a time of famine, they will be satisfied. In other words, the Eibushka might have helped that. If you planted and it got eaten by Chogov, okay, I can see I wasn't zoicha to that bracha, and neither was anybody else in this area, and therefore fine, you're entitled to deduct to reduce the rent that you're paying. But if you didn't plant it at all, how do you know that if you hadn't planted, that either wouldn't have been this bracha would have applied to me, and therefore you're still on the hook to pay the entire rent, and if you can't pay it out of the crop, then you're going to have to go and buy it, on the open market. So the Gemara says, Mosiv Rav Sheshes. So Rav Sheshes says, and I have a contradiction to that. We learned the Mishnah had mentioned in an earlier parak, and at the end of the seventh parak, where it talked about various dinim of shoyimim. Roya Shahoya Roya, if a shepherd was taking care of the animals, v'hiniach edroy, and then he left the herd of animals, uvolair, and he came back to the city. Now we talked about we learned yesterday, one possibility could be that he knocked off at the appropriate time, even though he's a shomer socha, we said he is entitled to leave at the time when people usually go home, and leave the animals to graze overnight in the fields. The other possibility we said is that, he could even maybe take a nap in the middle of the day. Another possibility the Gemara mentions over there is, for example, that he heard lions coming and he ran away out of fright. Now, the Mishnah describes over there, not the Mishnah, the Gemara describes over there to pay. If he's a shomer socher, then he should have. Then he has to evaluate. He would have to go. He'd have to go and be prepared to pay people to the other shepherds to come and help him fight off the lions. And if he can't, if he sees there's too many lions coming, then he's entitled to abandon his post and not risk his life. So in those kinds of cases, so then was the Avataroff of Arivadaras, then a wolf came and ripped up an animal, or a lion came and clawed and killed one of the animals. Taraf and Daras are different expressions for what wild animals do. Taraf would mean that it tears it apart and then eats it on the spot. Daras would be that it takes it back to its den and eats it there, as lions usually do. Whatever the case, and the lion doesn't always kill it on the spot, whatever, yeah. We don't automatically say that if the shepherd had been there, he would have been able to save the animals from the predator, and therefore automatically he should be chayev. We have to evaluate the situation. We would have to call Adim and see what the story was. Im yochol lahatzil, if we can evaluate that he would have been able to save, if he's a shrema chinam, then anybody that he can find to help him for free, and if he's a shrema socher, then anybody that he could find to help him for pay. The Gemara discusses that point in the seventh parak. So then chayev, then he's chayev because then he's a pesheya because he should have gotten other people to help him. The imlav potter, and if not, then we say he's potter because that's considered an oinus. And even a Shema Socher is potter from Oinus. Now, Vamai, now based on what Shmuel was just saying, that in the case of the Choycher, where he doesn't plant the field, the owner of the field has the right to tell him, you know what, if you had planted, then Hashem would have helped me, and the crop would have been safe from the locusts, and now, therefore, since you didn't plant, then it's your negligence, and you have to pay, well, why don't we say the same kind of thing, says Rav Sheshes. Vamai, namely, by the same logic, the owner of the sheep should be able to tell the shepherd, e habis hosam, if you had been there, have him a kayim bar, or b, there would have been fulfilled in me another pasuk, another thing that we find happened to a tzaddik when he was guarding the sheep. David HaMelech says on himself, gamas hari, gamas adov hikar abdecha. He describes to Shaul when he's proposing to fight Goliath, and Shaul tells him, you know, I mean, you're an inexperienced guy. Goliath is a very experienced soldier. How are you gonna be able to go up against him? And David tells him, you know, when I was grazing my father's animals, that a couple of times lions and bears attacked, and I was able to, and Hashem helped me, and I killed the lion and the bear. So Hashem did that, then it shows that Hashem will save me also from this Goliath, and I'll be able to defeat him. But the Medrash says on it, this is, you know, it's an example of, so he was sure why, he realized, why did the Eibishter bring those lions and bears? Precisely so that when he kills him, he should realize that he's able to take a lesson from it, that in the future, he'll be able to do this kind of thing with Goliath. The Medrash says in the same way, when Esther was taken to Ahasuerus's palace, that the Mordechai starts realizing, Haytochen, that a tzaddikus like that winds up by a lowlife like Ahasuerus, there must be a deeper reason for it, and therefore he's constantly checking on her welfare and seeing what's going on. In any case, the point is, so Rav Sheshes' logic is as follows. If Shmuel, if you're telling me that when the owner of the field has the right to say, Hashem might have helped me, l'mayla mederach hateva, and therefore if you didn't even bother planting, then you're on the hook for that, why can't we say the same thing? Why don't we say the same thing by the shepherd, that the owner of the sheep should also be able to say that Hashem might have helped me l'mayla mederach hateva, and you're still responsible because you ran away and left the wolves or the lions to attack the animals. Maybe you should have stayed. You should have stood your ground and fought the animals, and the Eibishter might have helped you. The answer is b'mishum d'omalei, because the shepherd can answer right back. You know what? If you were actually deserving of having a nest happen to you, then you would have had, there would have happened to you a nest, like what happened to Rav Chanina ben Doisa. The Masyan Izi Dubi Bekarnayu, where one time his goats dragged back bears that they had killed and impaled on their horns and dragged them back home. The Gemara tells in Tainus a story where one time somebody left some chickens by mistake by Rav Chanina ben Doisa's doorstep, and he started raising the chickens with the Hashavas Aveda. Me'ikra Din, earlier in the Masechta, we learned that the Gemara had, the Mishnah and the Gemara had discussed, Me'ikra Din, after a couple of days or weeks, he would have been entitled to sell them and set aside the money, and when the guy eventually shows up, he'll give him the money. Rav Chanina ben Doisa went l'fnim Meshuras HaDin, he eventually sold the chickens and used the money to buy goats. So this way, when the guy comes back, he won't just have some money that was sitting in a drawer, he'll have something that'll continue to grow for him. Wait. So let me just finish the story from Tainus. So anyway, the Gemara says over there, Rav Chanina ben Doisa's neighbors complain that you're raising goats in Eretz Yisrael. We learned in Bava Kamma, you're not allowed to. They're damaging our crops. Rav Hanina Mendoza says, let me tell you something. If what you're saying is true, and these goats that I bought out of this poor guy's money, if they are in fact damaging people's crops, then the bears that are roaming around the area over here should end up killing them. If not, says Rav Hanina, then fakir, the goats should kill the bears. That evening when the goats came home from grazing out in the fields, each one of them had a bear stuck onto its horns. It had killed the bear, b'derech nes, and schlepped it home on its horns. So everybody realized that there's no basis for, the whole thing is above a maisa. His goats are not damaging anybody's fields.
This property wasn't
outside. No, the pashtus were assuming that he sent them out to graze in the forests or whatever, like you're allowed to, as we learned in Bava Kamma. And in the forest is places where there are bears, so yeah. In any case, the point is, so you're saying ain't sin fenal nest, but the point is, that's what the Gemara is going to ask over here. The Gemara is sort of going to ask something along those lines. But right now, the Makshin is assuming that the same way as the owner of the farm has the right to say that a nest would have happened to me and my farm would have been immune from the locusts when everybody else's wood is getting damaged, and therefore it's your fault that you didn't make that possible by even planting the field, why shouldn't the owner of the sheep have the ability to say the same thing to the shepherd? So the Gemara says, why is that a valid claim? So we're saying the shepherd can counter argue that, you know what, if you were roaring to a nest, it wouldn't just be a nest that I would have been able to kill the lions or the bears. It would have been a nest that the goats or sheep themselves would have killed the wild animals. But the Gemara says, v'lei malei. Okay, but let the owner of the sheep out argue back. Fine, I wouldn't have been roaring to a great nest. Lanissa Zuta Kachazina, at least I would have been roared to a lesser nest. That the goats should kill the bears and schlep them home on their horns, that's an outrageous nest. That's the kind of thing that would happen to Rav Hanina ben Dosa. But a more normal thing, that a shepherd should be able to stand up against a lion or a bear, fine, it happened to David HaMelech. It's not a unique thing in history. There's been other times in history where people have been able to overpower wild animals and kill them. So why can't? So then the owner of the sheep should have a valid claim on the face of it. That I might have been roared to that lesser nest, and you had no business running away, and instead you should have stood your ground and tried to fight off the wild animals. And if you didn't, then you chayev. So how does that fit with what Shmuel is saying, that he has the right to say that if you didn't plant the field, then because you didn't plant the field, therefore no nest had happened. If you had planted it, then it might have I might have been saved from the locusts. So the Gemara says, you're right, kasha. It's a kasha how to reconcile those two things. Tosfos points out that an earlier part of the Gemara, which is not here in Ein Yaakov, mentions a point that the owner of the field can say, let's say for example, the choicher planted a different kind of crop than was supposed to be there. The deal was he was going to plant wheat, and instead he planted barley, let's say. So now, if it gets damaged, then he has the right to say, sorry, you don't get a reduction of your rent. If you had planted a wheat, then there might have been mekuyim for me, the sigzer oim of a yakam loch, as it says about a tzaddik, that a tzaddik goes about kodesh bochum akayim, that maybe I would have been able to say, that I would have been able to tell Hashem that my crop should stay intact, and it would have. But what was I davening for? Wheat. I didn't know you planted it barley. I'm davening for the wheat crop to be successful. So Tosfos points out, because the case we're talking about over here is he didn't tell him specifically what kind of crop to plant. So he has no ability to say the sigzer oim of a yakam loch. He has no right to assume that the Eibishter would have accepted any generic tefillah of his, that my crop should be successful. To say that, to dive into Hashem specifically, let my wheat crop be successful for that. Yeah, he has a valid claim that might have happened. But to say generically, to hold himself as such a great tzaddik, that anything that he plants should be successful without a nest, that not. But nevertheless, the Gemara is saying that at least he would have had the ability to daven. Yeah, so fine, he wouldn't have had that, but at least he might have had the schus that even without his tefillah, the Eibishter would have protected his crop, and therefore if there was no crop because you didn't plant in the first place, then you can be held responsible, is what Shmuel is saying. Whereas on the other hand, when it comes to the sheep, we don't say that. You notice over here, you have the line in Hayom Yoyim that, you see when something is really negea to you, then you're going to come up with whatever arguments you can in favor of it. And the example is given that you see that even Amaya Oretz and Pshutei Am are able to come up with arguments in Halacha. Here is an example of it. You're talking about a shepherd, who's Lav Davka, the most learned person, but he's still able, when his back is up against the wall and he's going to be made to pay, then he can come up with an argument based on the story of Rav Hanina ben Dosa. Further on, save this for tomorrow, Vessel Shem. Okay, Yom Yom Mashiach of Geula, Yud Aleph Tevis. Yesterday we had the fast day. So when we talk about, so yesterday we talked about a piece of a sticha where the Rebbe was talking about that when you're on a fast day, you see the pnimius, the inyan of that a fast is yom yotzen l'Hashem because it'll become sasim b'simcha. So now the Rebbe expands on that idea. When we talk about these fasts that are going to become sasim b'simcha, moridim tovim, they're going to be on a greater level than all the moridim of nowadays. Because we talk about that the moedim of nowadays are going to be bottle loss in love. We talk about kishraga batira. It's going to be like a candle in the bright noontime. Relative to the giluim of Yemos Mashiach, all the things for which we celebrate the current, the present day Yom Tovim are going to fade into insignificance. Because they're going to be so much less important, so much less significant than Yemos Mashiach. So then certainly they're going to be lesser than the Yom Tovim that come about new in Yemos Mashiach, namely the Dalad Tzomus that are going to turn into Yom Tovim, so therefore the current Yom Tovim are going to be on a much lower level, much less significant than those four new Yom Tovim that are going to be established on the days of the fast, on the days that are currently the fast, that are going to be established as Yom Tovim, La'asid Lavi. It means exactly what it sounds like. It means there's going to be a Yom Tov, Asar of a Tevis. It means... because it becomes a Yom Tov, because now we realize Od Hashem Ki Anach to be. Now we realize that all the anger and all the everything, all the seeming negativity of it, that's what the Rebbe was talking about yesterday. That even now we can begin to realize the pnimius of the Ratzon HaElyon that's in it. The fact that the Eibishter himself gets involved and so to speak cleans up our averus, cleans up our filth. So already then we can have an idea of that. You know, you yourself have the song about Tisha B'Av, about the Yom Tov Tisha B'Av, don't you, sir? Yeah. So, yeah, my oldest son, by the way, loves that song. Yeah, sings it all the time. Yes.
Still have 10 minutes.
Yeah. Okay. So we'll do several. We'll do several halachas. Yeah. Yeah. Myra's 5:20. That's true. That's true. I forgot. I thought it was 5:15. Okay. Every so often. Maybe not such a bad idea. Everybody, I mean, everybody barely put their things over here, but still. All right. Yeah. You know what? We'll do. We'll do more halachas. It's fine. Okay, we were talking about the halachas of the bathroom. So when a person sits down, he shouldn't all of a sudden start going, because then that opens it up very widely and it damages the muscles over there. And also he shouldn't push too hard. So wait a little bit before you start. When it comes to wiping, you don't wipe with your right hand because you use your right hand to tie your tefillin on. Now, in Madura Basra, actually, the Alter Rebbe explains that applies only when a person is wiping with his bare hand. So then you can't wipe with your right hand because of that. When a person is wiping with toilet paper, then the Alter Rebbe says in Madura Basra, it's not an issue. So anyway, with the right hand, you tie on the tefillin, so therefore it's not appropriate to use for wiping. As far as a lefty, then it's the other way around. He ties the tefillin on with it using his left hand onto his right arm, therefore you shouldn't wipe with his left. What about then if you have a person who's mostly a righty, but he writes with his left hand, then still the din will be that then he still wears tefillin on his right arm, because in general you go, when it comes to tefillin, well, when we get to Hilchos Tefillin, we'll talk about it, that primarily you go according to which hand you write with. So even if he's mostly a righty, but he writes with his left hand, then as far as the halachas of tefillin is concerned, he's considered a lefty, and therefore, again, he would not write with his left hand, because then he would be putting shvan tefillin on his right hand. Cases. I think there was a son of the Tzemach Tzedek that was ambidextrous, and I think there was a discussion that he might have to wear tefillin on both arms. So what should he do as far as wiping? I guess always use toilet paper, and then he doesn't have the issue. I don't know.
He wrote with both hands?
I don't remember what the scenario was, if he actually wrote with both hands or what it was. I do know that there's a couple of truvas from the Tzemach Tzedek on the subject, and I think the conclusion was that he has to actually wear tefillin on both arms. Then the Alter Rebbe goes on to say that also, for that matter, even when a person is using his left hand or right hand for a lefty, he shouldn't use his middle finger for that either, because the middle finger does have to do with tefillin. You wrap the strap of the tefillin around the middle around the middle finger. Now then the Alter Rebbe goes on to talk about what to wipe with, talks about, we learned about this in Madura Basra as well, about using shards of earthenware, and grasses and things like that, I think we'll mostly skip that, because, you know, we live now in a time which we can be very grateful that the Eibishter put us living in a time when we have toilet paper. So, this is definitely one of the things to have in mind when you say Asher Yotzar, is to thank the Eibishter for that as well. He says actually a general rule based on the Gemara that if you that wiping with anything that that's flammable, then you shouldn't, because shinyak akash noisrus, if you're noisrus, it causes things to dislocate over here, but l'chora that doesn't necessarily apply nowadays, because obviously toilet paper is flammable. So he goes on to say, actually, he does mention in Madura Basra that it really is best if, but that's actually, he mentions later on in Madura Kama as well, really the best thing is to wash with water, because then you get rid of any remnants of tzoya from the area, otherwise you have problems. As far as Torah and Tefillah, Me'ikra Adin, you don't have to do that. So nowadays you have wet wipes, it helps also. No, because it's different over here. We're talking about wiping soya, which is, you know, I don't know, yeah. Yeah, you get down to it. I mean, this kind of thing we're talking about over here. I mean, it's a, you know, anybody from Lahavdo, from any other religion or anything, would think that it's strange. We have an entire siman about the halachas of the bathroom, but, you know, we know that everything, you know, you serve the Eivishkeh and everything, even in going to the bathroom. But the fact is, it is soya. It is something low down and disgusting. We just talked in the Gemara about carrying manure on one's head, and therefore, you know, you have to have a certain keep things at bay to a certain degree. And yes, the Alter Rebbe goes on to say that nowadays people use things that are flammable, and there's no problem. Pukhazi mai amadaber. That's an example. As you can go and look what the common people do, and you can follow that. And in a number of cases of halacha, we say that what we find people doing on a regular basis is something. It comes out that then it's acceptable in halacha. Talks about using something that somebody else previously wiped with. Getting back to the matters of tzniyus, going to the bathroom, we learned about this earlier in the Siman, we learned about it in Madura Basra as well. So the same rules as far as not being in a place where other people can see him, and so on and so forth, so that the same kinds of things apply at night, except that when a person is doing outdoors, except that he doesn't have to stay so far away, because nobody's going to see him anyway. And therefore, if nobody can see him, then he can even be in Rishos HaRabim. Because anybody around, though, then you're not allowed to. But as far as urination is allowed, even B'fnei Rabim, because it would be a sakana to hold it back. The Gemara mentions it can impair a man's fertility to hold back urine when he needs to. Then the Alter Rebbe goes on to say that when a woman needs to urinate and she's not uncovering anything in front, as he said earlier in the Siman, nevertheless she shouldn't be doing it directly in front of a man, even a baby, because it's a chatzifus, it's a shameless way to act like that. But if she goes off to the side, then it's fine. Now, a person has urinated, and sometimes it happens that drops fall on your legs. So the Gemara mentions, and after that it brings, you have to wipe them off afterwards, because otherwise they're going to look like a krus shofcha. A krus shofcha is somebody who's damaged in that part of his body, where then the urine doesn't stream out as it usually does. It kind of dribbles out, and such a person is unable to have children, so then it's going to cause laws on his children. People are going to think that his children aren't really his own. So therefore he needs to wipe them off. The Alter Rebbe goes on to say, now later on in the Siman, actually beginning in the next sif already, he's going to talk about under what circumstances is the person allowed to hold the Aver. So if he's holding it and urinating, then it is at least mostly going to squirt out far away from his body, and only a little bit, there may be a little few drops that fall on his legs. But if he doesn't, and then a lot of it is going to end up getting on his legs, even if he wipes it off, it's still going to be noticeable. You still have the same problem of people thinking that he's a krus shofcha. So the Alter Rebbe says in that case, then urinate over loose dirt or from a high place to a low place or sitting down, and then there's no problem of these nitzotzes, and there's no problem of these drops splashing onto his legs in the first place. Nowadays, you urinate into a toilet, the pashto is the same thing, although sometimes it still splashes back anyhow, so whatever. I don't know, l'chora, maybe all of those dinim apply more when a person goes, when in those times when people went bare-legged, maybe it doesn't apply nowadays when people wear long pants, and it's not necessarily so noticeable. I don't know if the same dinim apply necessarily of having to be careful to wipe it off. L'maisa, if it gets on to a person's pants, he'd have to rinse it, he'd have to at least rinse it with water anyhow to be mevatalit enough that you should be able to say words of Torah or Tefillah afterwards, because you can't say them in the prayer, because you can't say those when there's urine around. So then the Alter Rebbe goes on to say that you're not allowed to actually hold on to the Aver, because that causes a motzi shechas der levatala. We learned about this in Madura Basra as well. He can hold it me'atoro lamata, close to the tip. Then that doesn't cause any arousal. And even if, the Alter Rebbe goes on to say, even if he is already aroused, even if he does already have a kishui, he still is allowed to hold that part of the Aver from that Torah and downward. He is allowed to. Maseyeh bebeitzim, he's allowed to hold up using the beitzim. That's not a problem. That doesn't cause hearer. Then the Alter Rebbe goes on to say, really, this is only if a man is unmarried or his wife is not around or she's nigger. If he's Torah and with him in town, technically it's called, it's past the salary. He has the ability to have tashmish with her anytime he wants. Therefore, in principle, he doesn't have such a yetzahara, and therefore he'd be allowed to hold any part of the Aver. Nevertheless, midas chasidus is to be careful, even if ishka imay, because it's such a severe avera. The Gemara says that the shmoitzi zedel batala is like bringing a marble to the world. So therefore, a person needs to be mekadesh atzmo mutaloi. What can he do? He can use a thick cloth to hold it, which won't cause any arousal, and then he can use that whether it's to urinate or also to check if he became a balkari. No, so that's a different matter. You're on Shabbos, you can't urinate from one rishos into another, no.
But in each rishos,
you're allowed to, yeah. Not on grass, for example, because then that has problems of zereya or other things like that. But yeah. To finish off, to round out that game, then the Alter Rebbe says that even a married man, when we say that technically if his wife is in town, then strictly speaking, he's allowed to hold on to it, would only be for urination, because again, you don't want too much drops to fall on his legs. But if he just needs to scratch himself or check for keri, that would be also to touch the Aver directly, even if he's married, and that would be also even Matara Olamata, even the end of it. So then the only heter is to use a thick cloth, which won't cause any kishri.